One third of the Earth's land surface is desert, inhospitable, often stark and punishing to our fragile little bodies. But it's utterly compelling. What is it about this brutal landscape that continues to captivate our imaginations? William Atkin's new book, The Immeasurable World, Journeys in Desert Places, takes us from the Arabian Peninsula's empty quarter to Australia's nuclear test grounds, from the sand seas of China's volatile northwest to the riotous Burning Man festival in Nevada's Black Rock Desert. It's a meditation on a very unusual set of places. William Atkins, self-described pale scribe from the drizzly shires, joins me now via Skype across the digital desert. Welcome, William.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, we often mean a sterile, dead space when we use the word desert. Is that your experience of deserts, both in your physical experience of them and in the realm of the imagination?
I think there's certainly that assumption, particularly we in Europe have about deserts, that they are kind of void places, that they're stripped not only of life, but of history and of culture. But of course, the moment you enter a desert, you realize that these are places of extraordinary richness and depth and meaning and significance and indeed life. I mean, deserts are not dead places. They are living and very often thriving places for all their sparsity.
And inhabited, and we'll talk in a few moments about the stories the inhabitants tell as opposed to the travellers. But you've said that you see your writing more as D.H. Lawrence than T.E. Lawrence when it comes to writing about the desert and about wild spaces. What did you mean by that?
I suppose that I'm slightly resistant to certain traditions of British travel writing, particularly kind of imperial and post-imperial travel writing, and I was being slightly facetious in that remark about Lawrence versus Lawrence. But I'm not an adventurer. I'm not an explorer. I'm really a writer and somebody who was curious about these landscapes, curious about this word desert. And as someone who, as you say, grew up in the drizzly shires in Britain, it was a landscape wholly unfamiliar to me. So I really wanted to set my preconceived ideas about this landscape, this word, against the reality.
Well, and you were very noble. You only briefly touched on the fact that this trip to various deserts came after a broken love affair. Was that part of why you chose that place? Was there an emotional resonance to choosing this stark landscape?
I don't want to overstress that element of the book, but I think for me it was important that I analyse my own reasons for being drawn to these places. I take to task some of the British explorers of the 19th century for not being particularly self-analytical about their true motives for going to these extraordinarily difficult places. And so I wanted to be frank about some of my impetus for undertaking these journeys. But also, I suppose, I mean, they say that the cure for loneliness is solitude, and there is something in these landscapes that can be, I think, comforting to those people who find themselves alone for whatever reason. I mean, one of the reasons that I became interested in some of the British explorers of Australia and the Arabian Peninsula particularly, is that I sensed that they were characters who found themselves marginalised or on the edge or not at the centre of their home society, i.e. Britain. And in the desert, they found an echo or something that they recognised in themselves in that sparsity.
And sometimes I get the impression that writing about really wild and uncultivated and untamed spaces is a way to impose some structure on them and tame them. Is that an idea that appeals to you? Is that something that was in the back of your mind writing this book?
I must admit it wasn't, but it does appeal to me as an idea. I think if we think about the desert as a blank, as a kind of a tabula rasa or a blank canvas, the work of kind of populating the desert with knowledge, with information, with people, with stories, with narrative, that is appealing to me. And so through the process of writing, you could say the desert becomes a rich place that once was kind of so sparse and so lacking in information. So that does appeal to me, yeah.
You also talk about the tradition of asceticism and people going into the desert to find this clarity of thought and this holy detachment. Tell us a little bit about how that informed your writing.
Yeah, well, I mean, the book began really in a monastery on the edge of Dartmoor, one of the few remaining wild places of England, a Cistercian monastery. And I stayed there in the course of writing my previous book, which was about English moorlands. And in the course of that particular stay, I began to read in the monastery library about the roots of monasticism, Christian monasticism, in the deserts of 3rd century Egypt. The Desert Fathers, as they became known, were really the first monastics, and they were people who had fled the cities, fled Alexandria in Egypt, gone to the desert in search of tranquility, but also in search of God, and to do battle with the devil. And so this relationship between place, between landscape and that very challenging landscape that the desert is, and a particular kind of faith, the monastic faith, and religious solitude, if you like, that became very interesting to me. And so the book emerged out of that particular interest, and an interest I had in Christian monasticism. So it begins, as I said, in Dartmoor, in England, in a very non-desert, very wet part of the world, and ends in Egypt, in St. Anthony's Monastery, which was really the first Christian monastery in the world.
I really was reminded of that quote from The Great Gatsby, where, you know, man comes face to face for the last time in history with something commensurate to his capacity for wonder. Though in that instance, it was more about, you know, can I monetize this new continent? What does it mean for me? And I'm wondering if there's something akin to that in the way people have viewed the deserts that they've visited in the past and the people in those deserts.
Yes, I think that's true. I think it's partly that we see or have tended to see deserts as places without value, or places where we don't have any values attached to them by an indigenous population, often as kind of blank places where we can do our dirty work. So the desert has often been perceived as a place that is unvalued, and therefore we can do whatever we wish there because it's impossible to somehow damage this place because it's a nowhere. Because as was thought by the British and the Australian government when they began their series of nuclear tests in Maralinga in South Australia, it was assumed that this was a place without a population, and a place also far from any population, so you could do whatever you wished and nothing would be damaged. And of course, they were very much mistaken.
William Atkins, could you describe the Burning Man festival that you experienced or possibly endured? Because it sounds like the antithesis of what a lot of people come to the desert seeking, that clarity of thought.
Experienced or endured, that's a good way of putting it. Burning Man is notoriously hard to describe. I make an effort in the course of about 20,000 words in this book. It takes place on the Black Rock Desert Playa, which is a great dry lakebed, ancient lakebed in Nevada in the USA, at the end of August every year. And you can think of it in terms of a festival, but there is not really a roster of musicians, for example. 70,000 people congregate every year on this extremely harsh, extremely isolated, flat desert landscape, and they party. And so there's lots of EDM, electronic dance music. There are these kind of towering lit up sculptures. There's enormous light shows. And at the center of Burning Man is this 45 foot tall wooden man, which at the end of this week of chaos is burnt, as is much of the other infrastructure of Burning Man. And for me, it was an interesting subject because I'm interested in the way desert landscapes have been seen as places of liberty, far from the kind of conventions and the mores of conventional society, far from the cities, somewhere where we can enjoy a freedom that we can't enjoy elsewhere, a kind of, yeah, sort of a liberty to be someone else. And so I think that's the appeal of that setting for those who go to Burning Man. But there is a kind of tension at Burning Man, as you can imagine, because you have this 70,000 people for a week, complete chaos, all camping, all self-sufficient, cooking for themselves. You can't buy anything at Burning Man. And it's very noisy and you never sleep, but it's very dusty and windy. And then outside the Burning Man site, beyond the fence, is the utter tranquility of the desert. And so I would often find myself trying to escape Burning Man. It was a very tough, physically tough week, psychologically tough week. Yes. But I would stand at the edge and look out at the desert and feel this tension between the tranquility of the desert and the chaos behind me.
It's also, when you talk about the we that are looking for freedom, it's a very specific we, isn't it, that has the freedom to go to this desert. And it contrasts very starkly with your descriptions of the Sonoran Desert between the US and Mexico and the people that go there under much more constrained choices.
Yes. During my time in the US, I stayed for quite some time in Tucson in Arizona, and became very interested in the desert, the Sonoran Desert, between the southern American border, the Mexican border, and Tucson, which is a kind of 80-mile stretch of extremely harsh desert. And it's this stretch of desert that undocumented migrants from Mexico, but also from Central America, are crossing in an effort to enter America, and dying in, well, numbers that are unknown to anyone, but certainly dozens every year, quite possibly hundreds. And one of the characteristics of that particular desert is that human remains, organic remains, disappear very, very quickly. And so the numbers of people who are dying in that desert are completely unknown. So I spent some time with advocacy groups and migrant aid groups going out into the desert and leaving water on the established migrant trails, in the hope that those desperate people trying to cross into America would find that water.
William Atkins, you've written about moorland, you've written about desert. Where are you going next? Antarctica? Space? What harsh environment appeals to you now?
This is the danger of kind of setting myself on this trajectory from moorland to desert, that the most obvious next place is probably space, yes, but I don't think anyone's going to give me an advance to go there. So I'm thinking about some of the themes that have emerged out of this book. I'm particularly interested in the theme of exile and the relationship between exile, political exile, and geography. So that's an area I'm exploring at the moment.
Exiles, hermits, and the conflicting stories we tell about deserts. William Atkins, it has been such a pleasure chatting to you today.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you. Author of The Immeasurable World, Journeys in Desert Places, on Blueprint for Living on RN.